Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. I'm also the Chief Marketing Officer for NeuroPoints. Today I have a great guest, someone with whom I connected through LinkedIn. We had an incredible conversation about the work that he's doing now, and I was just very intrigued by his entrepreneurial spirit. But as with any entrepreneur, there's a lot that leads to an individual becoming an entrepreneur, like Chris Groves. So I'm going to let Chris begin by introducing himself to you, and then we'll talk a little bit about his journey to entrepreneurialism. So, Chris, who are you?
Hey, thanks, Kevin. Thanks again for having me. Just a dude, man. grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where I was born and raised, and then moved around a ton. Actually, my mom was kind of a nomad, I like to say. So once my parents separated, she was all over the place. So I got to experience different parts of the U.S. So that was good for experience wise. In my later years, you know, I worked and dropped out of high school, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and did a little bit of college, which I also dropped out of. And then ended up joining, before that I had, you know, held a couple different jobs, worked at restaurants and then worked in sales and then worked as a VP of sales and then joined the military and then did that. And I just retired in November of last year and started this company, PassPass, with my brother. What was it? Almost 2 years ago. January will be 2 years.
That's awesome. Well, I remember meeting you right around the time you were getting it kicked off. Very excited. I want to hear more about that. I also want to go back a little bit, kind of rewind to that school experience, that home experience that you had that maybe helped to shape the person you are today. So do you mind kind of shedding a little bit more light on that and the impact you believe it had on who you are right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, when my parents were together, they were actually quite successful. They owned a stock brokerage house in Atlanta, Georgia. I was too young to remember any of this. They separated when I was about five. But I remember living in a nice home on a lake in Atlanta, and then poof, it was all gone. My mom moved out. My dad, my brother, and I, at first, me and my brother moved into a high-rise apartment with my mom. And then about 6 months later, we moved back in with our dad into a two-bedroom apartment complex in not a good area at all, where we were frequently exposed to, you know, bullying, robberies, all sorts of stuff going on. Basically, I'm not exactly sure what happened with all the money, but my dad got none of it. We went to live with him and he struggled through. And oddly enough, you know, he never held a 9-to-5 job. So I think a lot of my entrepreneurial spirit comes from, you know, watching my dad do different things. He was this close to being part of the dot-com boom. He had started a company called Virtual House, which had beat AOL to actually dial up. And they had dial-up internet and it was working. And his business partner, which he raised money with, took all the money and absconded to another country. And just totally left him, just burned him. Yeah, really messed up. His name was Alan Reno out of Texas. I'll never forget that name. I think I met him twice. And the last time I met him was, you know, I don't know, 8, 9, something like that. And I don't know exactly what happened to him. But yeah, my dad always talks about that, or used to. And then after that, my dad just went on a series of, you know, trying to start different companies and do things to pay the bills and enjoy what he liked doing. And he was an Air Force Vietnam veteran. He's an air traffic controller, but he loves music. My dad grew up playing music and he was great at music. He was in a band for a long time. And so then he went down that journey and just tried to do different things in the music industry and concert series and all sorts of stuff like that. So definitely, you know, growing up watching my dad have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit and watching him build things and, you know, unfortunately, none of them really panned out the best way possible. He never made it where he wanted to go. But that definitely instilled that spirit in me. I certainly think quite a bit. And my brother too. My brother ended up being in a band for years and years and years. And then again, he and I started this company as well. So,
well, that's very cool. And I think as you describe those early year experiences when your dad lost everything and, you know, had to restart repeatedly, that this whole mindset that a lot of people struggle with of risk aversion, it sounds like, you know, when you've been through what your family had been through, it's like, hey, I can't get much worse than here. So we got nothing but up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it certainly could have gotten worse. You know what I mean? And when you're a kid, I think as long as you have your health and your parents pay attention to you and you have friends and you get to go outside and play, especially in the 90s. I don't know about, nowadays, but in the 90s and 2000s, that's all there was. You know, we had a video game console, Nintendo 64 or Sega, whatever it was at the time. And that would be our inside activity. You know, I had a Game Boy or a Game Gear, but in general, I lived outside, it's how it was. So the good part about the apartment complex is there's tons of kids there. So outside of the negatives, there's so many positives, and you just had to see the silver lining and everything.
Well, you mentioned before we got on the call that you played violin since sixth grade. So obviously that was in your blood, being a musician and having a love for music. What drew you to violin and what kept you with it?
Yeah, oddly enough, so I never really had an inclination to play music that I can remember really until around that time frame. My dad inherited a violin from, I think, his great great grandfather, because his father died and his great grandfather passed this along, and it was a violin that was played at the World's Fair, the very first one, the World's Fair, and it won. He won the blue ribbon, first place, whatever. And he was like, "Hey, nobody in the family knows how to play violin. Maybe you should try." And so I was like, "All right, cool." So I joined the orchestra and I played, and my friends joined the orchestra. And really, at the end of the day, if your friends end up doing something, you end up doing it too. And oddly enough, we all kind of stuck through it. Once I was in that orchestra, the majority of my friends that stayed in orchestra, and we all ended up at the same high school together. Before I left that high school and went down to Palm Beach. But yeah.
I love it. Do you find that knowing how to play an instrument like the violin, being able to read music and so forth, helped you in any way with your problem solving, critical thinking? You know, they talk about the correlation between knowing music and being very thoughtful and a good thinker. Was there any impact that you noticed in that regard?
Think it'd be ignorant to say it didn't. You know, it's hard. Because you never really go back and put the pieces together. Sometimes I attribute a lot of my current brain power and the way that I think to my military experience. But I think even prior to that, when you really start to dig deeper, I was always a critical thinker. I was always the type of person that questioned everything, which didn't always go well. But I always like to know the why for something. And a lot of folks, especially in the military, you just told, "Hey, go do this." And I was always thought to myself, well, look, eventually I'm going to be put in a position to lead. I want to know the answer to this, because if someone asks me, I don't want to say because I said so. Like, we're not parents and children here. I want to know why I'm giving you this life-saving or potentially life-ending advice or command or whatever. And so that's really what it came down to me. I think it's just always being curious. And yeah, again, I think it'd be ignorant to say that music and learning how to read music and play music would not have contributed to that, for sure. Yeah.
Sure. What branch of the Army were you a part
Navy.
of? Navy.
Navy. Yeah.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about that experience and how that shaped who you are as well.
Yeah, well, I was in Naval Special Warfare, Special Operations, specifically Explosive Ordnance Disposal. So for the Navy, there's across all branches of service, you have Explosive Ordnance Disposal, which is the guys who go and take care of bombs, projectiles, underwater mines, improvised explosive devices. Every branch kind of has their own lane, so to speak. The Air Force is very much, response to ordnance that's dropped by, whether it's planes or whatever. The Army is very much response to ordnance in theater, dropped by the enemy or dropped by us that dud fired. The Marine Corps, their specialty is dud fired ordnance and inerting things and doing all that kind of stuff. And then the Navy is a big mixture where we kind of call ourselves the jack of all trades, because we're the only ones that's fully integratable into a special operations capacity. So what that means is, not only do we have to know every ordnance type, and we have to be ready to, kind of do route clearance like those guys were doing, or go respond to a dead fire ordnance like those guys were doing, but we also had to integrate with SEAL team, Ranger Battalion, Army Special Forces, whatever it was. And then we would be a freedom of movement kind of enabler. So if you were going to go on a mission, especially in, after kind of like the 2005, 2008 timeframe, you could not go on mission without some sort of EOD support, especially in a special operations capacity, because the IED threat was so high. And the last thing you wanted to do is get caught with your pants down with no one, knowing how to take care of it. And so we were highly sought after, highly targeted, obviously, for that exact same reason. And yeah, it was a really great experience. You know, it teaches you a lot in a lot of different ways. You know, we have a very long training pipeline. Just from my initial selection phase, there was about 40 of us that classed up, and from start to finish. Now, some other guys made it through, but they got rolled back, whether it be an injury or they failed some sort of test or whatever. But only six of us from the 40 made it through initially, start to finish, yeah, without getting rolled back. So it's a really tough course, you know, mentally tough, physically tough. And it's obviously not for everybody. Not, you know, when I tell people that, you know, you had to defuse a live improvised explosive device or even a dead fired ordnance and you don't know exactly what condition it's in, people are like, are you insane? And I think to myself, I mean, I guess, I don't know. Or, you know, I just have a false sense of security that my training has led me to, you know, believe that, sure, I know what I'm doing. I've died enough in training. You know what I mean? And you're constantly doing something to challenge yourself. And, you know, sure, if you're not improving, then obviously I think most guys understand if they've kind of got a hold on it. And the guys that didn't, obviously, yep, didn't make it, yep, very far.
You're talking about the training, though, and, you know, kind of feeling the sense of confidence when you go into the real situation. But I'm curious, when you look at the simulation experience versus the actual, was there, I don't know, did you feel like the simulations were obviously powerful enough to prepare you for the real life situations, or is it a totally different ballgame?
There is quite obviously, I think most people would just assess, there's a difference between a training simulation and then, you know, it happening for the real time the first time. For example, you know, we did tons of training, but what I will say is when it happens, your training takes over. You're immediately falling I mean, you're going to rise to your level of preparedness, if that makes sense. You're not going to fall back on your training. You're rising to your level of preparedness. So if you're not well prepared, you're not going to react well. But I explicitly remember my very first time, and this wasn't like combat or anything like that. I just remember first deployment, and I was tasked. I was in Africa, and there was some dead fired ordnance from basically a battalion had gotten into something, and basically we had left a ton of ordnance on the battlefield. And they were like, hey, you are going to liaison with French EOD. And we need you guys to go out there and clear what's left over. There's basically some dead fired 81 millimeter mortars. And I'm like, okay, I'm brand new. Right. So I'm kind of thinking I'm just going to take lead from this French guy, 'cause he was old. He had like four teeth and he just like seemed like he didn't care. It was very weird. It was like, it was like being paired up with a guy from World War II. It felt like, you know, he was out of shape. He was smoking a cigarette and he just did not give a shit. And I was like, okay, this guy's obviously a badass, you know, like, and he's got a shovel in his hand. And I'm like, I didn't bring a shovel. I guess I'm an idiot. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. Right. And we go out there and the first thing he does, and one of the first things you learn with ordnance, especially because, you know, it's buried, meaning it got launched and it hit the ground, very hard, compacted dirt, and it's just sitting. And so about, you know, a half of the piece of ordnance is sticking out of the ground. And the first thing you learn, especially as an EOD tech, is like, until you can assert the condition of the fuse is at the nose of it. And it tells you, you know, is the fuse intact? Does this thing still have the ability to fire? Or did the firing pin just get hung? Is it, you know, is the spring just cocked back and the striker's waiting to go home? Like, you don't know. And I'm following this guy, I'm, you know, bebopping behind him, and he just takes the shovel. He gets right up behind it and he's just looking at this, you know, tail boom sticking out of the ground, which is still a full up round to me. And he just stands there and I'm like, okay, you know, I'm thinking like mentally take notes. And he just takes the shovel, goes back like this, like it's a golf club, and whacks the back of the piece of ordnance. And I'm like, oh, like, right. I immediately just like took off 20 yards in the other direction. And I'm like, what in the hell is this guy doing? Right. And he just keeps whacking away. I'm like, he's going to die. This is it. This guy's just out here. He wants to kill himself. Eventually he knocks it loose and then just rips it out of the ground. And I can see that the fuse itself is completely destroyed. And he just assumed, or assessed, I guess you could say, that because it impacted hard dirt and it had, you know, not porpoised, come all the way through, it would just have been impacted there. The fuse must have been destroyed. But that's not always the case, because I had a pull line. I had a 300 foot, you know, rope. and I attached it to the tail boom of a different one, and I pulled it out of the ground with a truck, and the whole thing was intact, completely intact. And I was like, and so that's why you do the remote pull, right? You do the remote pull because if it does detonate, you're not right next to it when it happens. And this guy was just whacking him with a shovel. I couldn't believe it. So that was like, I was like, oh my gosh, man, I can't believe this dude just did that. But that was probably the biggest shock to me. I was just like, nothing could have prepared me for that. You know, we had simulated combat, we had simulated explosions, we had simulated being yelled at and everything possible, you know, mortar fire coming in, hitting the deck, anything, like RPGs coming in, like everything you could possibly imagine, except for an old salty dude going up and hitting around that you think is in the condition of fire
right
next to you. It was almost suicidal to me, right. And I just couldn't believe it. So I was like, oh my gosh. But yeah, I'll never forget that for sure. Nothing can prepare you for that.
So how did experiences like that prepare you to do what you're doing right now and tell folks what you are doing right now?
Yeah. I think, you know, critical thinking is obviously a big one. And then seeing first order effects, second and third, fourth, mm-hmm. fifth order effects, tertiary, whatever you want to call them. Basically, if I make this action, what other things can be impacted?
Yeah.
And a lot of that goes into the core mission of EOD, which is protection of personnel and property. That is our first and foremost, you know, that is what you go by. And so if the action you're going to take could destroy personnel or property, you need to know every single thing that's going to happen if you take that action. And then you're deeming whether that action is safe. So similarly in business, right? Or when you do I'm the president right now, but I do a lot of our marketing. Mm-hmm. I oversee all of our social medias, basically all of our revenue. Yes. And so for me, yes. I'm thinking, okay, if we do this, what will happen? I'm trying to anticipate the moves that we make and, plan best case scenario and also worst case scenario for whatever it is that we decide to do. So, hey, if we're going to take this action, what is it that's going to happen? What's the best case? What's the worst case? And then obviously let's plan for worst. And then we, you know, usually end up somewhere in the middle or even best case.
You know, I remember you telling me in a recent conversation about a very successful marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Yeah. We've basically just kind of stumbled into it. We knew the giveaways were working, obviously. When we first launched our product, it was really hard to get people to care about a deal, right? There was like Honey and there's Groupon and there's all this other stuff. And what we wanted to do was aggregate it, make it simple. We wanted to add local businesses, and we wanted to incentivize the local businesses to also join in and tell people, hey, if you join this program, you're going to get a discount here, but all these other places too. And so we created this great affiliate program for the businesses to where if they put a QR code on site and someone mm-hmm. signed up there, they would get revenue from it in perpetuity. What we found out very quickly is obviously, you know, subscription revenue of some sort, just revenue when the lights are off. Everybody needs it. But if it's not your core business proposition, you're probably going to let it go to the wayside. Restaurant, for example, when their lights are off and there's no customers inside, they can't make any money. But our thought process was, well, if we can get them on our program and they can sell memberships by giving away some food or some sort of incentive, they can. And they all agreed unanimously. They're like, this is such a great idea. We love it. But when push came to shove and they needed to actually train their staff, they needed to implement it into their sales flow in some way, shape, or form. They just said, look, it's just too much. We don't, you know, we need to focus on selling hamburgers or whatever it is. And so we said, okay, how do we get people to give a crap? So what we started to do is we started to do giveaways and we put them inside of our app. So we said, hey, businesses, give us some gift cards. We have geolocation because we already built that through our app. We'll give away gift cards to local users. So that's one of the other incentives that they can have to join. Like, hey, win a $25 gift card. Make that the acrylic frame stanchion on each table or wherever it is, right? And so we kind of went that direction. People loved it. People started downloading the app and all these other things. And then we went one further. We said, okay, well, how can we really drive traffic, you know, locally? And we met a guy who now works for us, basically. And he was doing a very unique thing. And it wasn't exactly profitable for him. But he was just doing these fun scavenger hunts where he was dropping money all over, you know, Southern California. And we came to him. We're like, hey, man, like, have you ever tried to collaborate or like tell people to go download an app or try a three? You know, he's like, no, you know, I've had a business reach out and give me some gift cards, pay me $100, whatever, but nothing crazy. You know? And I thought to myself, I think this would be really good. You know, we're already kind of dipping our toes in the giveaway thing at this point. We've started to double down on it, in fact. And we said, I think we should just give away some money and then tell people, hey, if you want to win more money and get prizes and you know, get discounts, save money too, and you can earn money with us, then go download our app, right? Put it in the bio, tell people about it, put in the story. And so we did that. Basically, we partnered with him. And the first time we launched, we decided to do 30-day free trials to the app. And the very first post that we did with him, we converted like 140 wow. people overnight, literally from, you know, registration to free trial, which means they were putting in their credit card information and 30 days later they were going to renew. And we thought to ourselves, well, crap, we didn't actually have to pay outside of, mm-hmm. you know, the money that we dropped, right? And as part of the scavenger hunt, we didn't have to pay for customer acquisition. We didn't have to set up marketing funnels. We didn't have to set up all this crazy stuff. We just basically said, okay, well, let's just do that again. Right. So then we went out and we brought him on board, long story short, and we built now 12 pages. Right. So the thing that's crazy about this is if you want to mm-hmm. play the scavenger hunt game, you want to be a part of it, right. you have to physically live in the city. Right. So big Fortune 500 corporations, nobody actually has anything like this. Right. So if Taco Bell said, hey, you know, Post Malone is going to be over here, I'm sure people would show up. Of course, right? You get a celebrity attached them to it and they'll show up, but you got to pay millions of dollars for something like that. We can physically drive hundreds of people to any location in the city that we're in, collect first party data and have a blast doing it. Right. Mm-hmm. We just did one in Arizona a couple of weeks ago with a company called Pepper Lunch, who's very fast growing, fast casual restaurant here in America. And we drove almost 300 people to their location on campus at ASU and no one had ever been there. We didn't ask a single soul that didn't say, we've never heard of this place, but it's good. We're coming back. We didn't know this was here. It's good. We're coming back. And all we did was host a scavenger hunt. And then we handed out some raffle tickets and we raffled off, you know, another mm-hmm. $500-$600 in prizes. And we had every single person there try the food. They got a coupon to come back, and we collected 1,900 name, phone numbers, and emails of people that live in Arizona at a cost that is beyond fractional of what it would normally cost you. And then to go beyond that, the content's evergreen. We posted mm-hmm. that on our Phoenix page, and it got something like 300,000 or 400,000 views. We had story views, yeah. all these things, and it'll live there forever. It'll keep showing back up in people's feed, and it'll remind them, like, oh, yeah, Pepper right. Lunch. I'm going to go there, right? So very unique. You know, we launched it in Southern California first, so L.A., Orange County, San Diego. Oddly enough, when we did Los Angeles, we grew to 70,000 followers in about 3 weeks, and the Ryan Seacrest show reached out to us via Instagram and said, hey, I'm the producer of the Seacrest show. Ryan saw what you're doing. He wants you on the show. And so we went on there and we told Ryan, hey, by the way, we also went to the same high school as you. And he was like, no flipping way. He went off script and started talking about high school. He's like, that's my alma mater. But yeah, Dunwoody High School, which was hilarious. Of all the people that could have reached out, it was Ryan Seacrest, which we thought was really
cool. Small world. Wow. Yeah. That's a god. Wow. That's great.
Yeah. So then we did that. And then we opened up Phoenix and then Nashville, Tampa, Washington, D.C., Boston, New York City, Pittsburgh, and Charlotte goes live this week. Charlotte, North Carolina. Wow. Yeah. So it's been a fun ride. Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, like you just said, you've not been at this all that long. I remember talking to you when you were first kicking it off, and to hear the success in such a short time is really remarkable. So let's shift gears a little bit on that and think about those who are out here watching and or listening to the podcast. What are some words of wisdom or advice or inspiration that you could offer to other people, young people that are aspiring to be entrepreneurs or old people that want to be entrepreneurs? What would you say to them?
I would say undoubtedly, no matter what walk of life you're in, old, young, middle-aged, doesn't matter. The thing that is going to impact your entrepreneurial journey the most, and of course, this is my humble opinion, is your personal development, right? I think you are uniquely qualified for whatever you've set yourself up to be. So you are currently the sum of everything you've attracted to yourself in your life, right? So if you want to become a more attractive person, and I don't mean physically, of course, that is part of it, right? Then go work out. If you want to speak more eloquently, then go to start doing Toastmasters, read more books, learn how to do personal development, win friends and influence people, read that book, read every single book you can get your hands on, and then start putting it into practice. That's where a lot of people, you know, they fail. They'll read, they just won't turn on the light switch. They've got all the power in the world. They've got all the knowledge. They just won't turn on the light switch. And a part of that, again, is personal development. You have to get out of that, you know, expand your comfort zone. Because people, you know, they say, oh, I don't want to get out of my comfort zone. Saying getting out of your comfort zone sounds uncomfortable to people, so they'll never do it. So just expand it. Just, you know, just, okay, my line's here. Let's just move it over here a little bit. Let me just dip my toe in, right? But it's really not all that difficult to do. And you're working on yourself relentlessly. And that's something that never stops. You have to constantly be curious, constantly keep working on who you are. Notice the triggers that make you lazy, your good habits, your bad habits. Notice what makes you uncomfortable and then challenge yourself to change it. Notice what makes you angry or gives you anxiety or whatever it might be, and then challenge yourself to change it. And if you can do those things, it doesn't matter what you walk into in life, you'll be able to conquer it. But when you're weak mentally, because you don't work on yourself and you don't have the knowledge to know what to do in these particular situations, then you're just not going to get anywhere. And knowledge, yes, of course, is potential for power. Like I said, it's potential for power. You know, I could read every book in the world, but if I don't try and attempt to go apply it, it's not going to work. And perfect example, when I was going through training, there was guys that could recite every single piece of ordnance to you, every single key ID feature, you know, how that fuse worked, how long it was. They could look at it and tell you that's an 81 millimeter mortar. It's from this country. The Cyrillics say this. They didn't even have to translate it. But then you put your hand, they put their hands on it and they would flail. They would absolutely, they just didn't know what to do, right? So they couldn't do the mind to hand coordination. But that's because they'd never been challenged in that way before. And so that's something they had to work on.
And it's not, we're human, right? So it's not that we're not haunted by some of those, you know, voices of you can't do this or you shouldn't do that or whatever. So just kind of speak to that a little bit too, because I'm guessing you dealt with some of that as well.
Who doesn't?
But push through it. Do you or not?
Absolutely. I'm saying who doesn't? Yeah. I don't think I've ever met anybody that didn't have self-doubt, especially at one point in their life. Even still to this day, you know, there's certain things that I'll get self-doubt about. You know, something as silly as, you know, when I was single, talking to a girl, you know, you don't want to get turned down. Who cares? Right. Who cares? You know what I mean? The less you care, the more confident you are in yourself and your ability and what you have to offer, the less you're going to care about what other people think. And that's really what it comes down to. But I mean, of course, I mean, self-doubt, any of these things, they plague every human being. And if you don't work on that, if you just accept it, you just say to yourself, well, that's just who I am. You're quiet.
Right.
You're constantly quiet quitting. And there's okay if that one thing isn't particularly holding you back. You know, like, oh, I'm not a morning person. If that's not holding you back, if you're still successful and you don't want to get out of bed till 10 o'clock and you're still crushing it, then fine, whatever. But it's not who you are. So you've allowed yourself to become. That's just what it is.
Yeah, I love that. Well, this is a perfect time, actually, for me to ask my final question of this episode, and that is there anything else, Chris, about which you're just thinking that I didn't give you the chance to speak to? So what are you just thinking, brother?
Really not too much. I mean, you know, when you're asking these questions, I'm thinking to myself, what would I have liked to hear, of course, in my younger years? And it always comes right back to the same thing, personal development. The harder you work on yourself, the easier life becomes. It's just the facts of life. And when you just choose to be the person you are, whether you know, intentionally or unintentionally, that is going to drive the direction of your life, period.
Love it. Well, that's an awesome note on which to end. So I just want to thank you for being part of Just Thinking today.
Likewise. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me.